vengeful obsession and descent into madness is worse, inconceivably worse. The insistence of Job is that the properly faithful human being retains his upward aim and devotion no matter what. Those are dread words indeed. But it is that insistence that enables Job to regain his feet and to prevail once again, even to do better after the cataclysm. Given the inevitability of failure and catastrophe, and even the apparent injustice of fate, what could possibly be better and even more believable news? It may be hard for someone in the position of the merely human to forgive God, so to speak, for his or her terrible trials and tribulations, deserved and undeserved alike. That is not the point being made in the story of Cain and Abel, nor in the book of Job. What is put forward instead is a proposition. When terrible things happen, tragic things, unjust things, faith, humility, and courage, despite all, to say it again, nonetheless constitute the best strategy, the best pathway forward. That path might not even be all that good, might even appear as the soul of misery itself, particularly in the short term, but it could still well be better than the infinitely terrible potential alternative. We all need desperately to know how to make the best of a bad deal. Breaking faith with the spirit of being and becoming itself is not an advisable strategy. Quite the contrary. Cain convinces himself of something like the following. Here I am, breaking myself in half in my efforts, trying to do my best, yet nothing is going my way. And there goes Abel, waltzing so blithely and easily through life, granted everything, loved by everyone, smiled upon by God. How can that possibly be fair? Is all that not only unjust, but also emblematic of some deep and fundamental flaw in existence itself? Thinking that way, daring to think that way, the soon murderous brother calls out God, "What are you up to? What kind of world did you make where my labor is futile, my sacrifices unrecognized, my alienation total? All the while, Abel is dancing away with all those who love him in an endlessly welcoming and productive field of spring, women, and flowers." And God immediately makes a bad situation worse for his wayward son, responding as conscience in the most unwelcome terms imaginable. Once again, "If thou doest well, shalt thou not be accepted? And if thou doest not well, sin lieth at the door. And unto thee shall be his desire, and thou shalt rule over him." Genesis 4:7. The emphasis on desire is telling, as is the imagery of the doorstep, combined with the necessity of an invitation to enter, submission to the will of God as an alternative, and the insistence that mastery of such temptation is both necessary and possible. God says to Cain, in effect, "Sin crouched at your door like a sexually aroused predator, and you invited it in, knowing full well it was sin, and let it have its way with you." God lets Cain know, in no uncertain terms, that the fault lies in the human domain, and it is God himself speaking rather than something or someone easily disavowed, a fact which, of course, heightens the devastation. The Lord says, in effect, "The flaw here is not with me, it is with you. You have allowed something terrible to enter into your soul and engaged in unholy intercourse with it. Worse, you did it of your own free will, and you know it, and you could have done otherwise, and you know it. How is this to be understood? Imagine that you are bitter, cynical, nihilistic, and faithless because you do not believe that you are getting what you had bargained for. Perhaps you have your reasons. On what do you begin to dwell? On what do you begin to brood? What do you invite in to take hold of you? Those are all variants on the sexual metaphor. How are you then tempted to enter into a creative partnership with evil? To put it, once again, in the bluntest, colloquially Anglo-Saxon manner possible, how fucked up are you willing to allow yourself to become? Cain wishes most devoutly for God to take responsibility for the pain and disappointment attendant on human existence. God upbraids him in a manner precisely opposite to what he most longs to hear. Cain's request is therefore not only rejected, God turns the tables on him. This makes Cain even more unhappy and vengeful. It is one terrible thing to have your sacrifices rejected and to fail. A whole new level of existential misery emerges, however, when you are informed in some incontrovertible manner by exactly what or who you are accusing, that your own conduct is fully and completely to blame for your failure and misery, that you have made everything much worse than it had to be by your refusal to do even what you know to be right. This is a very damning judgment, and it could not happen to Cain at a worse time. This is what typically occurs in the case of the most damning of judgments. 3.8, fratricide, then worse. After a colloquy of this sort, after God himself has let it be known that the hell now occupied by Cain was brought about by the latter's own personal shortcoming, wrongdoing, and vengefulness, a sensible person would disappear, meditate, and repent, regardless of the fact that coming back from such an abysmal place would be something both difficult and unlikely. Instead, and somewhat predictably, given the dark side of human nature, Cain doubles down on his presumption and pride, rises up in his thoroughly self-justified anger, and kills Abel. And Cain talked with Abel, his brother, and it came to pass, when they were in the field, that Cain rose up against Abel, his brother, and slew him. Genesis 4:8. He does so, furthermore, after lying to his good and much admired brother in the most manipulative and ironic possible manner, after inviting him to cooperate in the very work or sacrifice over which their paths diverged and their differences arose, according to other translations of the verse. One day Cain suggested to his brother, "Let's go out into the fields." New Living Translation. Worse, Cain does so after discussing the recent conversation with God, which implies betrayal subsequent to sharing something deeply private and painful, and therefore establishing a bond of trust. And Cain told Abel, his brother, New American Standard Bible, 1977. Cain talked with Abel, his brother, about what God had said, Amplified Bible. It is difficult to conceive of a strategy more false and manipulative. Cain destroys God's favorite, God's ideal, to attain vengeance on that favorite ideal and, simultaneously, on God. In doing so, however, the murderous brother also destroys his own ideal, because it is Abel that Cain most desires to be. It was Cain's lack of what Abel has and is that served as the deepest source of his torment. When he slays his brother, therefore, Cain demolishes all that is holding him together, everything that protects him from despair, all that offers him guidance and hope when lost, everything that enables him to progress forward, upward, to the eternal promised land. There is a moral order. Beware of unintended consequences when it is violated. The murderous brother commits, in a very real sense, the unforgivable sin, severing any chance of further relationship with God. From some dark lands, there is no hope of returning. For if we sin willfully after that we have received the knowledge of the truth, there remaineth no more sacrifice for sins, but a certain fearful looking for of judgment and fiery indignation, which shall devour the adversaries. He that despised Moses' law died without mercy under two or three witnesses. Of how much sorer punishment, suppose ye, shall he be thought worthy, who hath trodden underfoot the Son of God and hath counted the blood of the covenant wherewith he was sanctified an unholy thing, and hath done despite unto the Spirit of grace. Hebrews 10, 26 to 29. Insofar as Abel is a precursor to, foreshadowing of, or type of Christ, and Cain the same in relationship to Satan, the parallel between Cain's sin and the sin against the Holy Spirit, Matthew 12, 31 to 32, is apt. In consequence, God tells Cain, "So now you are cursed from the earth, which has opened its mouth to receive your brother's blood from your hand. When thou tillest the ground, it shall not henceforth yield unto thee her strength. A fugitive and a vagabond shalt thou be in the earth." Genesis 4, 11 to 12. Nothing the now damned brother works toward will ever come about. He will wander and hide forever. Such is the fate of the individual who murders his own highest aspirations, the ultimate form, perhaps, of hiding the light under the proverbial bushel, Matthew 5, 15. Cain understands he is lost, with the same certainty he knew he was at fault following his last dialogue with God. He cries out in consequence from the depths of the abyss, "My punishment is greater than I can bear. Behold, thou hast driven me out this day from the face of the earth, and from thy face shall I be hid, and I shall be a fugitive and a vagabond in the earth. And it shall come to pass that everyone that findeth me shall slay me." Genesis 4, 14 to 15. This is once again reminiscent of Dostoevsky's Raskolnikov, who, in the aftermath of his dreadful and hypothetically successful and justified crime, finds himself so alienated from everything he had so unconsciously taken for granted that punishment comes as nothing less than a relief. Who can live after destroying his ideal? After destroying that ideal in a deeply premeditated act of spite? Who can live after destroying his ideal, knowing full well that the fault for so doing lies unquestionably at his own feet? Who can live after finally destroying all connection to the transcendent and absolute? And why is Cain a vagabond in the land of Nod, which means land of the wanderer? Because all those who pattern themselves after Cain become alienated from everyone. They deceive and cheat and offer what is second best. The people around them catch on in short order and determined to have no further relationship. In consequence, the bitter and the voluntarily second rate have to seek out new territories to despoil, new hosts to parasitize, new innocents to corrupt. Colloquially, as well, to visit the land of Nod is to go to sleep, thanks to the poet Robert Louis Stevenson. This is to be or to remain or to become, however willfully, unconscious, just as Cain is unconscious, just as those who hide their lights are unconscious in his unwillingness to awaken to the reality of his true nature and his obligation to God. And this is only the beginning of the ensuing, spiraling, multiplying hell. Cain's children and their children walk in their father's dread footsteps. And worse, Cain's fifth generation descendant, Lamech, kills one man for wounding him, Genesis 4:23, prophesying proudly that anyone who dares kill him in return will be avenged, not the mere seven times that would be experienced by anyone daring to kill Cain, Genesis 4:15, but by 77 times, Genesis 4:24. As noted in the Cambridge Bible for Schools and Colleges, the first note of warfare is sounded in this fierce exaltation in a deed which has exceeded the limits of self-defense and passed into the region of the blood feud. The possession of new weapons and the lust of revenge are here recorded as the typical elements of the war spirit. Although technically the law of vengeance was satisfied by a life for a life, yet in practice, the avenging of blood was often carried to the utmost length of ruthless ferocity. For one life, many were taken, the murderer and his kinfolk together. Cambridge Bible for Schools and Colleges. The story worsens even more after that, proving once again that hell is most truly a bottomless abyss, proving that no matter how bad things get, there is some damned thing that might yet be done to worsen what is already a terrible situation. The descendants of Cain, carrying the spirit of his sin, degenerate into an accelerating murderousness, a tendency that culminates, perhaps, in the doings of Tubal-Cain, the instructor of every artificer in brass and iron, Genesis 4:22, and, along with his brothers, Jabal and Jubal, the first makers of weapons of war. Together, they taught men to form weapons of brass and iron and taught them the use of armor and introduced war into the world. And when they had made these things, they made war upon each other, and the multitude of weapons went at once to try their inventions. Josephus, Antiquities of the Jews. This is an outline of the causal pathway, not only to the corruption of the soul, but to the degeneration of the state itself, as well as the technology upon which the state hypothetically depends and certainly utilizes. First, the individual fails to make the proper sacrifices. Second, he lies about it in a self-serving manner. Third, he nurses his bitterness, alienating himself from the divine purposefully, working himself over time into a self-righteous fit, collaborating with the spirit of sin. Then he destroys his own ideal to obliterate the terrible judge and to wreak vengeance upon the spirit of the cosmic order. Then his descendants disseminate that pattern of destructiveness throughout all of society until every last man and woman is irredeemably corrupt, and all of that stemming from the original failure to work in earnest and gratefully, and do so while turning to the inappropriate worship of technological prowess. Then, absolutely everything collapses in catastrophe. it is no coincidence whatsoever that the cataclysmic twinned stories of the flood and the collapse of the tower of the faithless, presumptuous, and authoritarian state follows on the heels of the terrible tale of the hostile brothers. The unerring eye for an edit that managed exactly this sequencing is a profound, even miraculous indication of the genius of the collective unconscious or divine hand that penned and assembled the text. God attempts to forestall this spiraling descent into the abyss. He marks Cain to forestall the emergence of the pattern of continual and expanding revenge and mutual destruction. Why does he do so? The meaning of this marking is elaborated on in H.D.M. Spence Jones's late 19th century pulpit commentaries about the Bible. 1. To show that vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. 2. To prove the riches of the divine clemency to sinful men. 3. To serve as a warning against the crime of murder. To this, probably, there is a reference in the concluding clause, and the Lord set a mark upon, gave a sign to, Cain, lest any finding him should kill him. Commentators are divided as to whether this was a visible sign to repress avengers, the rabbis, Luther, Calvin, Piscator, etc., or an inward assurance to Cain himself that he should not be destroyed. Aben Ezra, Dathe, Rosenmuller, Gesimus, Tuke, Kalish, Delitzsch. H.D.M. Spence Jones, Pulpit Commentaries. Dearly beloved, avenge not yourself, but rather give place unto wrath. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, saith the Lord. Romans 12:19. Why is this written? Why is this transfer of responsibility for revenge, even perhaps for justice, necessary? Because a civilized society must place a delay between the revelation of a crime and identification of a perpetrator and the reaction to that crime. First, to remove from the victim or the victim's family the terrible burden of vengeance. And second, to protect society from the consequences of vengeance seeking. The longing for justice requires that the guilty do not go unpunished. The voice of thy brother's blood crieth unto me from the ground, Genesis 4:10. But it is very difficult to distinguish that longing from the wish for revenge, which can be a devouring force, both psychologically and socially. It certainly could be argued that the former, that longing for justice, is in fact a later developing and more sophisticated or equilibrated expression of the impetus toward revenge, and one that requires precisely a delay in responding and the intermediation of an external and comparatively dispassionate agent so that everything relevant can be taken into account before the necessary sentencing. Cain's sin thus can be seen to initiate the accelerating tit-for-tat pattern of response that culminates first in blood feud, which can easily span generations and that may well constitute the pattern for the more or less continuous warfare potentially characterizing the norm in our ancestral past. Why did it take us so many hundreds of thousands of years to progress towards complex cooperation and productive peace, despite attaining our current genetic identity that long ago in the past? Was it at least in part because we mired ourselves in pointless cycles of self-reinforcing revenge? That is not all, of course. It is difficult for the force that enables and justifies theft from the productive to be replaced by a truly productive social contract or covenant. But failure to do so was no doubt a major contributing factor to the impoverishment and brutalization of human existence and remains so today. A distrustful society will never be an abundant and peaceful society. The ever-present threat of honor killing is a major deterrent to trust, even though the tilt in that direction might be regarded as a moral improvement over the stance characterized by mere take it on the chin and cower weakness. Furthermore, and in consequence, the impulse towards such honor is deep and a priori there in the beginning, there as a matter of immature but powerful instinct, although not abject cowardice, to say it again, and not something easily subdued or, better, transcended. If you or someone close to you is hurt by someone else, particularly if there is an element of malevolence or of unforgivable willful blindness and carelessness about the transgression, the pull for retaliation appears most temptingly in the guise of moral necessity. If I was a good, honorable, courageous person, a proper defendant of my family and territory, I would be duty-bound to take steps to wreak havoc on the perpetrator of this atrocity. And there is certainly plenty to be said in support of that proposition. But that is a road dangerous to embark on. First, at a psychological level, that impulse to vengeance rapidly becomes something indistinguishable from pride. The fathers who kill their own daughters when they are raped, for example, do so for no other reason than pride. Their pride, in fact, honor, is precisely what is besmirched by the transgression. That is not desire for justice or even for revenge. It is overweening presumption and something capable of destabilizing everything and willing to. Civilized societies, with their monopoly on power, take to themselves the scale and sword of justice. In so doing, they lift the moral burden off the targets of criminality and malevolence, allowing them to return to their lives, free of the demands of just punishment, protecting society simultaneously from the perversely respectable danger of the honor code. During the time men live without a common power to keep them all in awe, they are in that condition which is called war, and such a war as is of every man against every man. In such condition, there is no place for industry, because the fruit thereof is uncertain, and consequently no culture of the earth, no navigation nor use of the commodities that may be imported by sea, no commodious building, no instruments of moving and removing such things as require much force, no knowledge of the face of the earth, no account of time, no arts, no letters, no society, and which is worst of all, continual fear and danger of violent death, and the life of man, solitary, poor, nasty, brutish, and short. Thomas Hobbes, The Leviathan. In a civilized state, one that allows for sophisticated socialization and psychological integration, one that allows for productive, generous, and stable peace, the state, more deeply, the law, becomes the intermediary between perpetrator and victim. It is doing so, it might well be said, as an emissary of the divine, insofar as the divine will can be realized in this profane world. The mark of Cain is therefore, in keeping with this, the protection of God, the spirit of the law, as well it might be said, extended to the perpetrator to protect not only perpetrator, but also the victim in the deepest possible sense, and the stability of society itself. This is why the right to vengeance is rightfully reserved for the transcendent spirit of unity. After God puts his mark on Cain, the latter departs. And Cain went out from the presence of the Lord and dwelt in the land of Nod on the east of Eden. Genesis 4:16. More specifically, however, he lives at such distance from God's grace that his place of habitation is indistinguishable from hell. This is how Milton describes the situation of Lucifer himself after his fall from grace. At once, as far as angels can, he views the dismal situation, waste and wild, a dungeon, horrible, on all sides round, as one great furnace flamed. Yet from those flames, no light, but rather darkness visible, served only to discover sights of woe, regions of sorrow, doleful shades, where peace and rest can never dwell, hope never comes that comes to all, but torture without end still urges, and a fiery deluge fed with ever-burning sulfur unconsumed. Such place eternal justice had prepared for those rebellious, here their prison ordained in utter darkness, and their portion set as far removed from God and light of heaven as from the center thrice to the utmost pole. A section from the pulpit commentary is dead relevant here. And Cain went out from the presence of the Lord, not simply ended his interview and prepared to emigrate from the abode of his youth, but more especially, withdrew from the neighborhood of the cherubim and dwelt in the land of Nod. The geographical situation of Nod cannot be determined further than that it was on the east of Eden, and its name, Nod, or wandering, was clearly derived from Cain's fugitive and vagabond life, which showeth, as Josephus well conjectureth, that Cain was not amended by his punishment, but waxed worse and worse, giving himself to rapine, robbery, oppression, deceit. Pulpit Commentary. Out of the presence of the Lord is the same terrible distance that Milton describes as from the center thrice to the utmost pole, the same terrible distance indicated by the geography of Dante's Inferno, with the ultimate occupant of the deepest possible pit, Satan himself. That is a reflection of the moral claim that evil is a consequence of remoteness from God rather than something in and of itself. C.G. Jung objected to this characterization to some degree, indicating that such a notion of evil risks underestimating its autonomous nature, capability to possess, and the threat that it posed. He thus adopted a more dualistic view, which has as its advantage the call to seriousness that the hypothesis of an active and motivated spirit of evil constitutes. The alternative and more classically Christian view, this is not to cast aspersions on Jung, whose concentration on the centrality of evil was particularly apropos after the events of World War II, is also of great utility. The notion that God is the center around which all good revolves, the very trunk of the great trees of life and moral knowledge, and that hell increases in severity in proportion to the extremes of marginal existence distant from that center. This lifestyle of vagabond, of alienated nomad, far from the societal norm or ideal, is precisely that adopted by the pitiless and oft sadistic career criminals known to moderns as psychopaths, that small minority even among the criminals, as well as those who commit the most frequent and often worst crimes. Not fit for decent society. That is not outdated Victorian moralizing, but wisdom. Those who refuse to make the proper sacrifices and who attack their very brothers in resentful vengeance particularly when they are deservedly successful, are also those doomed to wander, as their brethren in turn discover their propensity for deceit, betrayal, and vengeance, sever all ties with them, and force them on the path to find new and still naive victims. This motif of hellish distance is echoed in the commentary insistence that Cain withdrew from the neighborhood of the cherubim. The cherubim, as we have seen, are the winged forms who guard the east gate to the Garden of Eden, along with the flaming sword that turns every which way. These cherubim are angels of judgment, from whose discerning eye nothing less than heavenly is allowed to slip. They are the monsters perched at the very edge of categories themselves, where judgment is most called for and most difficult. They are the judges of edge cases. Clarifying this point requires a return to discussion of the fact of and relationship between the margin and the center. Every element of order, that is, every perception and conception, every form of organization, psychological and social, has an ideal at its center, and indeed has a center, more generally speaking, surrounded by a margin. That margin is not its opposite, to say it again, as a simple thesis, antithesis, conceptualization might have it. It is instead the infinitely graduated plurality of difference or opposition that surrounds anything identifiable. It is instead the world and all its complexity juxtaposed against the specific, comprehensible, familiar, particular, and useful. The margin is thus less than ideal by definition, according to the presumptions of definition that allow for anything central to exist. Its existence is inevitable, as plurality has its place in contrast to unity, and it is also a place of necessary freedom and experimentation. Nonetheless, it contains monstrous forms. It can in that manner be a form of hell, not least as distance from the ideal or God, whose judgment becomes ever more extreme and threatening in precise proportion to the degree of deviation. The increasingly unrepentant sinner can therefore apprehend little more than the burgeoning anger of God. The fact of that inability can also so perversely justify continuation of or further sin. That is a true self-devouring spiral downward toward the abyss. Cain lies, and habitually. That path of lies leads him down the road to fratricide, the destruction of his own ideal, and estrangement from himself, man, and God, from center to lonely, vagabond margin. Someone who lies clearly steps away from the good, the truthful and upward-oriented logos who makes the cosmos that is good. More prosaically, perhaps, someone who lies steps away from his own judgment. This occurs first in the edge cases, where careful discrimination is most difficult, where the lie is therefore most easily engaged in and rationalized. It can all too easily become the habit in all cases, however, as the hierarchy of value through which the world must be viewed becomes pathologized. With practice, the lie becomes not so much the deviation from the proper and truthful mode of being, but the lens through which the world itself is increasingly viewed. The liar, therefore, comes to inhabit a story where everything is improperly ordered, given the wrong due. This warps the world, so it becomes a place of alienation from self, community, and God, so that it becomes a field that brings forth nothing but thorns. so that the divine itself becomes little more than the most terrible of judgments. Those who lie come to value the wrong things, and to do this consciously, at least at the moment of each lie. Alternatively, and more poetically, those who come to lie also engage in the worship of false idols, something akin to Cain's openness to possession by and collusion with the Luciferian spirit. This misattribution of value, something that becomes automatized when practice, becomes habit, becomes character itself, means that the world is now subdued in a false order, named with the wrong names, such that nothing ends up in its proper place, and that things of less value are given priority over those greater. How could it be otherwise in the case of the lie, which is, by definition, the falsification of the real? Of course, judgment becomes profoundly impaired when everything has been valued improperly, particularly when that has become a habit so deeply ingrained through practice that it becomes true of perception itself. As Father Zosima insists in Dostoevsky's The Brothers Karamazov, above all, don't lie to yourself. The man who lies to himself and listens to his own lie comes to such a pass that he cannot distinguish the truth within him or around him, and so loses all respect for himself and for others. And having no respect, he ceases to love. And in order to occupy and distract himself without love, he gives way to passions and coarse pleasures and sinks to bestiality in his vices, all from continual lying to other men and to himself. The man who lies to himself can be more easily offended than anyone. You know, it is sometimes very pleasant to take offense, isn't it? A man may know that nobody has insulted him, but that he has invented the insult for himself, has lied and exaggerated to make it picturesque, has caught at a word and made a mountain out of a molehill. He knows that himself. Yet he will be the first to take offense and will revel in his resentment till he feels great pleasure in it, and so pass to genuine vindictiveness. This is truly a descent into Dante's abyss, the pathway to an ever-deepening and expanding hell. When a man is living by a false story, valuing, celebrating, naming, and subduing everything improperly, nothing can possibly work out for him. Worse, as alluded to previously, all his adventures become false as well, because the goals he pursues are illusory, based as they are on the deception of self and other. The opportunities that beckon are not real. The obstacles that emerge in the pursuit are only figments of the imagination. When the world is subdued in improper order, no plans can possibly work. Lies render the presumptions that would otherwise support functional plans unreliable and invalid. This means that the liar is doomed to continual failure, that his increasingly false sacrifices will be increasingly and forever brutally rejected. This is exactly what happens, for example, to the Pharaoh in the great story of Exodus, who doubles down on his tyrannical insistence as the ever more terrible plagues mount, Exodus 7:13. When the sacrifice that is false and insufficient reigns, anxiety mounts, as does hopelessness. How can the future appear bright when nothing turns out the way it is supposed to? Or even if the desired but false end is attained, no true satisfaction makes itself manifest? How can any relationship be maintained when deception, worse, self-deception, rules? The liar is hopeless, lacks direction, and is destined for conflict, not only with all the others who cannot understand or outright refuse to share his lies, but with whatever remains of his true self, his true conscience, his true calling. Impair your judgment until you have no judgment at all, then die, and painfully, because you refused and continually to sacrifice your presumption, your false ideas, even when you knew with certainty that they were false. We have now dealt with the full narrative of the hostile brothers, although not entirely with its extended consequences. Cain's sin not only leads to the chaos of the flood, as the effects of resentful bitterness cascade from the personal to the social, but to the authoritarian catastrophe of the Tower of Babel, as those who turn from God and the path of proper sacrifice must turn to alternative means to unify and ensure successful adaptation. Cain's descendants are also the builders, the engineers, the makers of cities, musical instruments, tools, and implements of war. Genesis 4, 17 to 23. This is not to say that building or engineering is something wrong in itself, only that the fundamental problem of ethical conduct is not amenable to a technological solution. There are no better tools in the hands of misguided strivers. Better tools when the aim is wrong merely means more rapid movement down the wrong road or toward the wrong up. If proper conduct is rejected as the basis for the necessary covenant with being and becoming, as in the case of Cain and his descendants, then technical mastery beckons as an attractive substitute. It also has as its attraction appeal to the Luciferian pride that inevitably accompanies the desire and willingness to reject the absolute and transcendent. It is a given, in some real sense, that the mastery of tools has lifted much of the burden from human life. But it is also true that any given technology can be employed for evil purposes as much as good, and that the law of unintended consequences also lurks eternally as a complicating problem. Technological development in the service of what God? This is the eternal conundrum that finds its expression in the popular and recurring trope of runaway technology. Ex Machina, 2014. The World's End, 2013. The Matrix, 1999. The Truman Show, 1998. Jurassic Park, 1993. RoboCop, 1987. The Terminator, 1984. Blade Runner, 1982. The Black Hole, 79. The Stepford Wives, 75. Westworld, 73. The Andromeda Strain, 71. 2001, A Space Odyssey, 68. The Time Machine, 1960. The Fly, 58. The War of the Worlds, 53. The Man in the White Suit, 51. The Day the Earth Stood Still, 51. The Invisible Man, 33. The Island of Lost Souls, 32. Frankenstein, 31. And Metropolis, 1926. This list, although comprehensive, is by no means exhaustive, but it does indicate with its breadth the degree to which the combined problem of pride, resentment, and the worship of the technological both preoccupies the imagination and poses a serious threat to humanity itself. The answer provided by the earliest stories in Genesis and then echoed through the biblical corpus? No solution outside the proper universal and uniting ethos can quell anxiety, provide hope, and equilibrate social discord, no matter how conceptually and technically sophisticated. In fact, In the absence of such an ethos, technology threatens rather than benefits. Technology becomes the handmaiden of power or the means of escape from responsibility and the true moral order. The turning away from God and the failure to sacrifice properly corrupts and degenerates, and simultaneously motivates the efforts of the prideful intellect to build structures that obviate the need for God and the burdensome moral striving that relationship with Him requires. Where must the story of the descendants of Adam and Eve therefore and inevitably proceed to from here? Downward, inevitably, to the utter chaos of the flood. Upward, alternatively, to the domain of totalitarian order and the skyscraper reaching all too triumphantly heavenward, nonetheless doomed to collapse. Those are the two pathways we encounter next. What is the alternative? The far more difficult, sophisticated, and complex path of the welcome and ultimate sacrifice, ultimately pleasing to God, laid out in the entire remaining corpus of the biblical narrative. Chapter 4. Noah. God as the call to prepare. 4.1. Giants in the land. After Abel dies and Cain departs for the vagabond land of Nod, Adam and Eve find themselves blessed with another son. That son is Seth, whom tradition regards both as a replacement for Abel and the ancestor of all who conduct themselves and sacrifice properly. And Adam again had relations with his wife, and she gave birth to a son and named him Seth, saying, God has granted me another seed in place of Abel since Cain killed him. Genesis 4:25. Various commentators have concluded the following in their centuries of study. Seth was called appointed because he was appointed by God to be the father of the righteous and to replace Abel, whom Cain had killed. It is well known that Jesus was of the line of David, who was the descendant of Seth. This means as well that the messianic line was established through Seth and not through Cain. Among other things, these conclusions indicate that the pattern of attention and value established and typified by Abel did not die with him, and more generally, cannot die, and that the same pattern, in some manner, was not only immediately reestablished, but characterizes both King David and Christ himself. This idea is echoed in the highly evocative and image-laden manner typical of the biblical corpus, particularly of the very oldest stories, in a phrase that otherwise appears mysterious and opaque. There were giants in the earth in those days, and also after that, when the sons of God came in unto the daughters of men, and they bare children to them, the same became mighty men which were of old, men of renown. Genesis 6:4. These lines have spawned speculation far beyond the ordinary sort. The Nephilim, these giants, have been considered honorable robbers, lawless gallants, mighty men, unique in size, even fallen angels. The simplest explanation, anthropologically and psychologically, is that what is remembered across time is not so much the specific empirical details of a given life, no matter how notable, but the abstracted pattern of what is notable in general about life. Thus, in collective memory, the exploits, even the essence, of the ancestor become a purified amalgam of all that grips attention and compels mimicry in the heroic or anti-heroic sense, as a villain is as good a lesson as a leading man. The efforts of the ancient Romans to deify their emperors is a well-known manifestation of this same tendency. The same process is undertaken today among authors of fiction, who abstract out from the many characters in their imaginations a central pattern or spirit of character that is maximally compelling and memorable. When a person departs and is, say, eulogized, the most memorable of their exploits are brought to mind and communicated. In a culture dependent on the oral transmission of information, multi-generationally, an ancestor's most memorable qualities are going to become conflated in collective memory, especially after all those who actually remember a given person shuffle off this mortal coil. The stories, however, can live on, but in compressed and purified form, with the attendant characters living as active entities in imagination. The pattern of the ancestral heroes inevitably emerges and tilts with time toward virtual or actual deification. As Mircea Eliade points out, the passage from ancestor worship to theism occurs when the ancestor is divinized, that is, when he is transformed into a god. This transformation is made possible by the discovery of the sacred, or rather, by the identification of a particular manifestation of the sacred with the ancestor. He says, similarly, elsewhere, ancestor worship is one of the factors that favors the development of monotheism. In the course of time, the ancestors are more and more identified with the god. And finally, the god completely replaces the ancestors. Thus, history becomes fictionalized. Although fiction is best regarded in such a context as the creation of abstracted metatruths rather than the antithesis of fact and therefore of truth itself. The life of an ordinary man, which cannot even in principle be remembered in its totality, is thus reduced to the best or worst of his exploits, to the gist or heart of the matter, and joins in spirit with the similar exploits of his peers and forefathers to become the veritable giants of the past. With time, therefore, kings become what is sovereign itself, or its antithesis, become the king of kings, or the force that eternally opposes that supreme kingship. Noah is one such giant, one such quasi-deified ancestral hero, a descendant of Seth, the second Abel, a son of the fallen angels who walked the earth in those days, a man favored by God, like the prelapsarian Adam, a model for admiration and emulation, made even more memorable by the stark contrast between his attitude and behavior and that of his contemporaneous peers. 4.2, sin and the return of chaos. At the point in the unfolding biblical narrative when Noah enters the story, the wickedness of Cain's descendants has come to dominate the entirety of human endeavor. This is a particularly negative example of the gigantism that comes to characterize the exploits of those in the past. In consequence of this widespread emergence and utter dominance of the tendency toward evil, God determines to destroy what he has created. And God saw that the wickedness of man was great in the earth, and that every imagination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil continually. Genesis 6:5. This means a variant retelling of the story, both of the fall of man and the murder of Abel, another account of the inevitable fall and then destruction of those who reject the fundamental moral order, those who are insufficient in their sacrifices, those who turn toward bitter vengeance and the exploitation of self and others, those who turn against God. This is no spiteful action on God's part, to be clear. It is instead the starkest of warning to those tempted to deviate. The road to the promised land is straight, narrow, and hard. Matthew 7:14. While the road downward to perdition is broad and immediately inviting, it is not that God is vengeful. Quite the contrary. It is instead that his insistence on an inviolable moral order, superordinate to the merely human, is correct, and that this order is so real that transgressions against it have real consequences. This reflects the reality of the human condition. Life is a game whose price of entry is death and worse. Human existence is the most serious of businesses. Thus, the wages of sin are real and consequential. In our pride and rebellion, we thus can and do make, like Milton's Lucifer, a hell of heaven, striving to bring even out of what is good something miserable and terrible. So stretched out huge in length the arch-fiend lay, chained on the burning lake, nor ever thence had risen or heaved his head, but that the will and high permission of all-ruling heaven left him at large to his own dark designs, that with reiterated crimes he might heap on himself damnation while he sought evil to others. Cain's descendants fall into sin, and the cosmic order degenerates until there is no option but that of complete collapse. This might seem harsh, is indubitably harsh, but it is clearly the case that civilizations can fail utterly and be subsumed so completely by chaos that even their memory vanishes. This truth is captured in the biblical text of the story of Noah and is a motif that is in fact very widespread because of its fundamental truth. In the Mesopotamian creation myth, for example, the Enuma Elish, the creator goddess dragon Tiamat similarly regrets her decision to act generatively. Her wayward first children, gods in this account rather than men, as in the story of Noah, heedlessly slay Apsu, Tiamat's male consort, order itself, and attempt to make a home in or on his corpse. This act of extreme carelessness enrages nature, the mother of all things, the very Tiamat who then threatens them all with destruction. This is another example, first of turning against or showing contempt for both tradition and the Holy Father on the part of the inhabitants of the created world, and second, of the inevitable consequences of doing so. This narrative trope indicates in part that cultures who concentrate too much on what passes for present wisdom, we can dispense with the superstitious foolishness of the past, will lose the vertical, traditional orientation that protects them against mere fads of consensus. There is a cumulative wisdom in mankind, but it is not a mere consequence of the incessant noise and clamor of the present day. It is instead something that has been gathered across an immense span of time in many situations, and as a consequence of the observations and reminiscences of many cultures. Its rejection in favor of the whim-possessed idiocy even of the collective present is all too often a precursor to the crimson flood, particularly when those whims are, as they are wont to be, hedonistic, power-mad, revolutionary, and political. The trope of destruction of the sinful by the gods also indicates that those who abandon and betray the spirit that makes for life more abundant because they are wallowing undeservedly in the wealth of material comfort left for them by the great and forward strivers of the past, doom themselves, however immaturely and unwittingly, to the incursion of chaos and eventual destruction. It is patricide or regicide, the most extreme possible act of overweening pride, willful blindness, and careless blasphemy. The fact of this disdainful murder enrages Tiamat, the chaos mother of all things. She determines to wipe her wayward progeny from the face of the earth, engendering a host of terrible soldiers to aid her in her battle, placing a deity known as Kingu, a veritable Satan, at their head. Bearing monster serpents sharp of tooth and not sparing the fang, with poison instead of blood, she filled their bodies. Ferocious dragons she clothed with terror. She crowned them with fear-inspiring glory and made them like gods, so that he who would look upon them should perish from terror. The god Marduk, who rises to rule all the Mesopotamian gods, is precisely he who confronts the monstrous chaos of potential in a manner directly analogous to that of the Hebrew Yahweh, who overthrows Leviathan and Behemoth, Job 40-41, at the beginning of time. Most generally, archetypally speaking, that superordinate deity battles either the giant representative of the current state or society, a now false God the Father, or chaos itself, most often in the guise of a terrible feminine force with serpentine features, the Great Mother. What is meant by the motif of the careless slaying of Apsu, avatar of order, in contrast to the chaos of Tiamat? Those who carelessly destroy the living spirit of the past invite the return of chaos itself. Nietzsche warned of exactly this when he announced the death of God, prophesying that nihilism and resentment would rise up terribly in the aftermath of this dreadful murder. God is dead. God remains dead, and we have killed him. How shall we comfort ourselves, the murderers of all murderers? What was holiest and mightiest of all that the world has yet owned has bled to death under our knives. Who will wipe this blood off us? What water is there for us to clean ourselves? What festivals of atonement, what sacred games shall we have to invent? Is not the greatness of this deed too great for us? The intuition of such backlash lingers in our souls. The apocalyptic dread that seizes us in our apprehension that nature herself will rebel, for example, against our technological presumption, is a modern representation of precisely this theme. We deaden the past at our great peril. The spirit of our ancestors created the infrastructure that supports us technically, developed the skills that we mimic in our productive endeavors, established the mores, rituals, habits, and presumptions that unite us psychologically and socially, and provided us with direction. We can reduce that irresponsibly to a spiritless corpse and attempt in a parasitical manner to live off or unconsciously within what has been gathered or garnered in consequence. This is a losing game, however, as what is being devoured in that unearned manner is not being simultaneously replenished or restocked. Once the storehouse has been discovered, it can be looted and exhausted. Once the brand has been established, it can be raped. Nonetheless, Once the carefully accumulated wealth of the past has been depleted, all hell is certain to break loose. This is an eternal truth. Modern stories put forward the same motif. In Disney's The Lion King, the kingdom of Pride Rock is reduced to waste following the arrogant and careless murder of the proper ruler, Mufasa. The agent of his destruction is his brother, Scar, as close an analog to Cain as could be conjured in the modern imagination, with a bit of Milton's Lucifer thrown in just to drive the point home. The rightful king is killed by the resentful brother. The once lush kingdom is reduced to a desert. Everyone is enslaved. Starvation threatens. There is no difference between that and the return of chaos. We subvert the spirit of proper order at our peril. When we do so, or threaten to do so, harbingers of doom emerge and announce themselves to the profound, wise, and attentive, as in the case of Noah. Nietzsche was very much alert to such danger, noting that we would be threatened in the upcoming centuries, both by the spirit of resentment and by nihilism. Nietzsche warned not least of the emergence of the spirit of resentment among those he pilloried as deeply poisonous spiders. For that man be delivered from revenge, that is for me the bridge to the highest hope and a rainbow after long storms. The tarantulas, of course, would have it otherwise. What justice means to us is precisely that the world be filled with the storms of our revenge. Thus they speak to each other. We shall wreak vengeance and abuse on all whose equals we are not. Thus do the tarantula hearts vow. And will to equality shall henceforth be the name for virtue. And against all that has power, we want to raise our clamor. Their justice, however, is always what is most harmful to the higher men. They want to crucify those who devise their own virtue. They hate the lonely ones among them who are always devising their own virtue. They hate the present ones. They always speak against the present ones and call them heretics and lawbreakers. And yet they are the complacent ones. They always talk in terms of equal rights and equal obligation, the rights of the herd. They want to be herded together with safety and numbers with regard to everything that flatters or gives rise to fear. They are a herd. Their good conscience is indeed a bad conscience, an incapacity for standing alone. They always know what is most tender and harmless, like a toothless old woman. They call that goodness, and they themselves are the good men. The offense of the herds, men against the higher men, is always the same. They force them to become herdsmen themselves. For the most part, they themselves do not believe in their ideal of the herd, and they inwardly despise it, but still they want it. That is what I call the revolt of the herdsmen. Nietzsche, thus spake Zarathustra. Dostoevsky made the essentially identical case at precisely the same time, not least in his novel, The Possessed, alternatively translated as The Devils. The possession of the modern mind by what Nietzsche characterized as ressentiment is most profitably and deeply understood as a modern variant of the eternal spirit of Cain. Ressentiment itself, if it needs a concept and a word, indicates a certain powerlessness and impotence of the will. One feels something to be injurious, but is nevertheless incapable of preventing it. One is too weak to take revenge or wage war, or one despairs of doing so. Hence, one has recourse to any means of hurting, with the help of which one can strike indirectly, that is, by means of injury, to something that does not belong to him, to something that is loved and respected by the person who is to be injured. As Walter Kaufmann, the great late 20th century translator and interpreter of Nietzsche, explains further. In Nietzsche's view, ressentiment is a disease of the weak, who envy and hate the strong and the successful, and who seek to bring them down by attacking their values and ideals. Ressentiment arises from a sense of powerlessness and frustration, and it is often expressed as a desire for revenge or a desire to tear down those who are perceived as being more powerful or successful. Dostoevsky, in The Devils, describes the process whereby the Russian soul fell under that legion of isms that came to Russia from the West: idealism, rationalism, empiricism, materialism, utilitarianism, positivism, socialism, anarchism, nihilism, and underlying them all, atheism. The great Russian novelist and essayist carefully details the danger he saw looming over Russia and the rest of the world in a manner that both uncanny